It's Tuesday, the 11th of February. It's time to get your grin on with the Grincast, here to discuss the world of gaming from the past week. I'm your host, Ace, and Jeremy is Nikki.
Hello.
We also have two guests with us this episode, Emily Bailey and Tom Hopewell from Antler Studios.
Hello.
Hi, guys.
They're here to talk about Project Grove, which is currently on Kickstarter. And that's what they're here to talk about, obviously.
Yeah.
We'll start how we often start with what's everyone been playing. Nikki, why don't you take us away?
Right. Considering I've not actually been on a pod for a while, you think maybe I've been busy playing games. Nope. I have actually not played much in the last couple of weeks. In the past week, I have pretty much been on my usual nonsense. Regular listeners will know exactly what I'm about to say. Azura Lane, marrying all the ship girls, because that's literally all I do in that game. I could finish the story, but nope. Why would I do that?
That's a story?
I don't know. I skipped the cutscenes. I'm not even kidding. I do. I'm really bad. I just want to marry the ship girls. That's literally it. But I've also been playing Ark Knights, which is the new game from the same developer. It's a tower defense game. You can't marry anyone yet, but it's cool, and there's some really nice like character designs. And it's not as auto as Azura Lane. Like Azura Lane, you can basically the actual gameplay is that it's a twin stick shooter, bullet hell, etc. But you can just literally hit a button and just let it play itself. You can't do that in Ark Knights. You have to clear a level first manually, then you can do auto, and there's no guarantee the auto will succeed. So you kind of have to always be keeping an eye on it. But it's
and you can't do auto unless you've cleared it without help, because you can have a character from another player join your team.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. I forgot about that.
That's part of why I don't get on with it. One, it's tower defense, and two, it's not very easy to just stick on auto. So I've played that week of release and not since.
Yeah, it doesn't help as well that like the systems aren't as Azura Lane's like background systems and like the other things you do outside of the core like combat are kind of like quite fun. Like you can send them off to do missions and then come back a few hours later and you can pick up the rewards. Ark Knights has a bit of that, but it's not as... The only way I can describe it is Ark Knights feels like I have to actually play it. Like I have to have it open constantly and I have to be checking it like every hour. Whereas the reason I like Azura Lane is because I can literally open it once a day, play for 10 minutes, and get like a small sense of gratification that I've made some progress towards things. It's a weird little... I don't know. I can't really explain it, but it's just like a weird little 10 minutes of my day that I'm just like, yay, I did something. But yeah, Ark Knights is requiring a little bit more, so we'll see if I stick with it. But otherwise, yeah, I've not really played anything else, at least not in the last week, so... That's me.
Well, that was short.
I'll probably be quicker because I'm an indie game dev. So at the end of my day of work, I never want to play games. So I've just been playing a little bit of Overwatch and some Dead Cells, which has been an absolute blast. Taking a while to get through it. But yeah.
Are you going to be picking up the DLC for that?
Probably, because it's one of the few games I actually play. So, but we'll see when it comes around to getting it. But I'm enjoying that, and then doing my usual Overwatch stints. Get sad that I lose lots and then stop playing.
Okay.
So that leaves me. So apart from playing my own game, which is Project Grove, which I just seem to be forever playtesting at the moment after like updates that we're doing, I've recently started to get back into Don't Starve, purely because me and my old lecturer Chris, I saw him, when was the game jam, Tom? Was that last weekend or the weekend before?
I think it was the weekend before.
Yeah, but God, everything's gone to a blur. Oh God. Yeah, he was. We were just chatting about games that we like, our all-time favorite games, and he mentioned Don't Starve, and I kind of forgot about it and how much I loved it. So I started doing some of that. which was nice. It was a bit nostalgic. But yeah, apart from that, mainly Project Grove.
Fair enough. Myself, I've still been playing American Dad Apocalypse Soon, mainly watching ads because there's so many. Well, watching one ad because it's just Raid over and over again. Because you need to watch that to speed up things and to unlock crates and blah, blah. But I have been making progress in that, so I'm counting that on my list. Dauntless, been playing through the new Hunt Pass. Dead or Alive Venus Vacation, I've actually stopped playing this past week because I've finally written my review for that. So apologies, listeners, you're not going to... Despite the title of last week's episode, where I believe it was called It Just Gets Worse Every Week, you won't be hearing any horror tales of Dead or Alive Venus Vacation. The Simpsons Tapped Out, mentioned that last week. The new event did start. However, it's not a Valentine's event. It's a Black History Month event focused on Dr. Hibbert and the three or four black characters that are in The Simpsons. It's all right. You're mainly just sending everyone on four-hour jobs and then coming back 4 hours later to send them on the same job again to collect stethoscopes and progress through Dr. Hibbert's backstory when he met his wife, which was either in the 70s or the 90s, depending on when the current season is set, according to Dr. Hibbert. He also talks about how he used to have an afro, which was either in style or was ironic. Again, depending on when it's supposed to take place. Quite like that joke. Also, Star Trek Online, working my way through the daily quests of the Legacy 10th Anniversary events. Been also working through the missions. The last time I played it, which was years ago, I did the odd mission here and there, but now I've been working my way through the actual episodes, so I'm doing the missions in order, because it has been a case of, oh, hello again, Commander. I'm like, I don't know who you are. And this past week, I've played the mission where you meet that character. Yes, very time travel. Let's just say time travel. Star Trek.
I have a quick question about this Dead or Alive game.
Go on.
Do you like actually play any volleyball in this one?
No. As I mentioned the first week that I talked about it, you tell the girls to start playing volleyball. They play volleyball whilst you move the camera around or take photos.
You
click on the camera icon, you move the camera to where you want to take a picture, and you take a picture. You can pause, you can speed up so it's double time, or you can skip the match. I was skipping lots of matches.
Yeah, because I'll be honest with you, like, I mean, I have a low opinion of Dead or Alive anyway, but I just looked at the Steam page and I'm like, these are just photos. This is just photo mode. Is this game just photo mode?
You managed to get on the Steam page, or do you mean the community page? Because the Steam page is region locked.
Am I on the wrong one? No, I'm on Steam.
Dead or Alive Extreme Venus Vacation.
Yes. Oh, apparently it's free to play.
It is. The game is region locked to Hong Kong and Singapore. You can play it in Japan, but not via Steam, I believe. You can download it, play it in your browser. But yeah, after the big Steam library updates, I found it in my library. I'm like, I messaged three or four people, do you have access to this game? No. Can you access this Steam page? No.
The mysterious appearing game.
So I decided to review it since I had access to it anyway. Last game that I've been playing is a demo for a game that's currently on Kickstarter, Project Grove. Before I get into that and how I broke two things, why don't you tell us about yourselves, Emily and Tom?
So I'm the producer at Antler Studios. We've been making Project Rove for since our university project. So that was in 2018. We completed our dissertation. And we sort of came up with this idea of having a sort of single placeable platform anywhere in the world as a puzzle mechanic. And it kind of just grew and grew from that one small, simple idea. And yeah, somehow we've ended up here launching on Kickstarter.
Yeah. So where we sort of ended up from that is taking that sort of, we started with mechanics, that's sort of our design process. We go from mechanics to then metaphor and all that other stuff. We've grown into this, which is a sort of, it's a single person puzzle platformer where you're playing as an aging alchemist named Edric and his robot companion Elpin. Elpin is that one mechanic that Emily was talking about. You kind of go around exploring this magical forest, collecting stuff, and eventually doing crafting, getting new abilities, and exploring the world. Sort of what we're trying to do differently to other puzzle games is we're trying to be an open world puzzle game. So where most puzzle games are very linear, sort of they lock you in a box, get out the box, we want to have a much more open and free environment where you sort of interact with these different elements and can kind of travel how you want to, and depending on what potions you brew, travel in different ways. That's sort of the high level, sort of where we ended up from that initial university project to now.
Yeah. Okay, that explains the game. What about yourselves? This was your university dissertation. Is that where you met?
Yeah, so we were all on a game design course at university. In our final year, we got together and did this as a group project dissertation. We then took it on to some competitions in the UK, which we didn't win, sad times. We realized it was something that we really wanted to take on. So we founded the company, the four core members founding it as directors, and have been developing it since. That's all how we started. Now we're Antler Studios, we're a UK games company, very small and indie, but yeah, that's what we're doing.
Yeah, with that government competition, we got to a finalist stage, so we did get some money out of it, but we didn't end up winning the end prize. But that kind of gave us the platform to launch ourselves to where we are now, which is essentially bootstrapping a game, but hopefully now, you know, we're turning to Kickstarter and we're trying to get Project Grove funded and Project Grove out there. So yeah.
Okay, how big is the team at Antler Studios?
It varies like month to month, because we use quite a bit of contract workers, because we don't have a stable income. It's difficult to have full-time employees. So it varies between four and six. We have the four core members, and then we often have a marketing manager as well, and then a secondary artist or second 3D artist on the team. So between four and six, the company is, yeah.
So you mentioned about Project Grove, how you're an alchemist. You have this one movable platform. There's also the potions that you create with obviously alchemy.
Yeah.
In the demo, you have access to the bubble tonic.
Yes. So bubble tonic is sort of the first one we introduce, but after bubble tonic, they branch out a bit. So that first potion, you get it, and that's the one you're going to get. And that's cool because it gives you some other affordances, allows you to go to the next area, explore things a different way, use geysers, stuff like that. But after that potion, you can then start to choose what you brew. So once you start getting a wider variety of ingredients, it allows you to brew different types of potions, which is where that sort of open world element to the game really comes in. And depending on what potions you brew, you can explore different places or go in different directions. Potion crafting is really where we add that complexity to the puzzle game, and we add those extra mechanics on top that allow the player to really experiment and explore the world. I think it's like a pretty standard like gamification way of sort of expanding, you know, you get some new things that allows you to explore different places. That's sort of what we're doing with the potions.
Is it fair to call Project Grove a Metroidvania without combat?
I think In a lot of ways, yes. I think it is. It's the way you explore is very Metroidvania-esque. You know, you get a new ability, get some new areas to unlock, and you can go back and explore some old areas in some different ways, which is very Metroidvania. You're right in saying there's no combat. You know, we want it. It's quite a relaxing, chilled experience. Hopefully, that's what we're sort of aiming for. But yeah, that's what we are. I think it is fair to say that on a high level, Metroidvania without combat is like the way the game's structured. But I think, you know, there's a lot more depth to the puzzle mechanics compared to most Metroidvania games, which is how we replace that combat experience.
Shots fired at Metroid.
Yes, all Metroidvania games have no puzzle elements compared to our brilliant ones.
Episode title.
Yeah, I'll give you a clickbait there. Don't worry.
So where has your inspiration for Project Grove come from?
Do you want to take this on, Emily? Or
yeah, there was like a medley of different games, wasn't there? I think sort of hopping back to one of the best puzzle games, Portal. Portal takes a really simple mechanic and encourages you to do different cool shit with it. Can I swear? Sorry.
That's fine.
Sorry. Different cool things, like
just not the hard swears.
Yeah, not the hardcore. I don't know, I'll go PG. And then Slime Rancher was another one. I think that was one of Harry's like big inspirations, and that was in the sense of sort of going out, retrieving sort of items, and then going back and doing cool things with it. So I'm trying to think of the other ones as well, Tom. God, it feels like ages ago we've designed this game.
Yeah, those are the sort of highlights, those two, you know, Portal for the puzzle stuff and Slime Rancher for that experience of, you know, going out, collecting stuff, coming back to a sort of a core base and doing stuff with that stuff that you collected is that sort of core loop that is really what we base the whole game off. Another game that we got inspired by, especially since it was more recent and also in the similar sort of vein in terms of funding, was Cube and Cube 2. Those are two puzzle games. That series of puzzle games inspired us when it came to puzzle making. I think those are the main inspirations for us.
Okay. What prompted the Kickstarter campaign?
Essentially, it was just, it's when you're bootstrapping a game, which I don't know if your audience will know that term, but it essentially means you're funding it and not paying yourself. So you're working, for me, I was working two jobs at the start, one for another game company and then one for Project Grove. And then I quit that job to devote more time to Project Grove, but I ended up having two other extra jobs on top of that. So I'm technically working about three jobs, and it just takes your toll. Like, it's, I guess in a sense, when you're developing a game, you have two sort of resources you constantly manage it, and that's time and money. And we have time, but you know, bootstrapping means it's going to take a long time to get this out. And the only way you can speed up time is by spending money on it. So get a new staff on, being able to employ, you know, more artists or an animator or a UI artist, really polishing things up and like allowing us to just do simple things like market our game. And we sort of looked at various funding options, and one of the ones that we sort of got told to go for when we were in our early stages after Transfuser, which is the UK government fund that we were finalists for, a lot of people said, oh, you know, reach out to publishers because that's a good way to sort of launch your game. But it turns out a lot of publishers said, because we were a startup and we had no sort of track record of games out there or any sort of supporting evidence for us as a company and as a group, they found it really hard to buy into us. Which is fair enough, because you know, you're asking them for what, 30 to 60k to develop a game and to invest in four individuals that they've never heard of. It's quite a big ask. So we spent about a year searching for that, and then we had a couple of publishers who really gave us a lot of good feedback, and they were like, we love your game, we think your concept's really cool, we even really like you as people, but you know, I don't think you're ever going to get a publisher at this stage. So we sort of spoke to each other, and we got Lauren on board to help us market our game, which has done a world of difference. And we kind of just realized that we have to sort of go back to the players. You know, every trade show we went to, people loved the concept and really liked playing the game, and were always asking, "What's, you know, when's it out on Steam? When's it doing this?" And we thought if anyone could back us, it would be our audience and hopefully new players to come. So that's how we sort of got to Kickstarter.
Yeah, I think the biggest influences for doing Kickstarter were that need to be able to work full time and put our full effort into it.
Yeah.
And also the fact that, you know, when we're at trade shows, I'll talk to someone about the game, they'll play the demo and we'll chat about it. And then their next question would always be, oh, so when's it coming to Kickstarter? They were just assumed that I was doing it, that we were doing it. And my answer was always, oh, well, we aren't doing that. And, you know, it's Kickstarter's one of the things that it's a lot of time and effort. You can't just put your game up there and expect everyone to give it money. So it is like a commitment that you have to make. But I think we decided it was a worthwhile commitment. And, you know, talk to us again in a few weeks and we'll let you know if it was a worthwhile commitment. But yeah. Hope that answered that question.
The campaign itself mentions Bring Us the Moon, which is, again, had a successful Kickstarter, but it was fraught with issues afterwards. What lessons did that team impart to help you avoid those?
So I know the dev, Paul, quite well, and Paul basically gave us loads of advice, and part of it was just be completely transparent and honest with your backers, because that's the main thing that people want. I think people can accept delays and setbacks, but as long as you're open and as long as you're transparent, they sort of learned that, you know, game development is a very expensive industry to go down, and they ended up needing more money, so they had to reach out to other sources, including publishers, and it was only once they got that support they could actually fully deliver us the moon out there. So in terms of their lessons, it was more a sense of be 100% committed to your campaign, because it's going to take a lot out of you. And I had to stop all my part-time work for January and this month February, just because I knew I wouldn't be able to do two things at once. Like I just wouldn't have been able to commit that time that I needed. So that was one of them. And also he kind of just said, it's, you know, sometimes you get lucky, sometimes you don't. Kickstarter is a funny platform. When they launched in, I think it was 2016, it still had a fairly good reputation as a platform. But now, I mean, you see games like The Wonderful 101. You know, they were a game dev who, I don't know their funded situation, so I can, you know, you never know what's going on behind closed doors, but they got a huge investment from various Tencent. Different companies. Yeah, from a Chinese company. Huge investment. And, you know, they're on Kickstarter. We're on Kickstarter because we genuinely, you know, we don't have another source of income for this. So it's kind of make or break for us in that sense, that we do genuinely need the money. It's not a marketing PR stunt. It's, you know.
And yeah, I believe I brought that up in the last episode of the podcast. We talked a bit about the Wonderful 101 Kickstarter, and I was wondering, where did that 10-cent money go?
Yeah, and I try not to judge, because you don't know what's going on behind closed doors. You don't know what that dev's, you know, situation is. So I can't, you know, shame them or anything like that. But it has a knock-on effect for devs like us. You know, I wish we were doing Kickstarter as a marketing stunt. But, you know, it's way more than that. So there were some lessons that he could sort of talk to us and inform us about, and gave us some really, really good tips. But then there's others that, you know, the platform's just changed so much since 2016. So, you know, you have to learn some of the lessons yourself, I guess.
Yeah, I think for me personally, like, the main thing that Paul taught me when I spoke to him was about when you're actually thinking about what you're going to make and what you're going to put on Kickstarter. It's just make sure you're giving someone a finished product. Players really don't like it when you, you know, are giving them, you know, the first segment or the first game in a trilogy. You know, that's not what they want. They want a finished final product that leaves them satisfied when they finish it, you know? And it's something that game devs, I mean, I naturally wanted to do that. You know, when we were down scoping the game, I naturally wanted to say, oh, we'll release it, you know, bit by bit. But that just doesn't really work for players. And you need to accept that as a developer, that players want, you know, to play something all the way through. And that was the main thing that I learned from Paul, I think. Especially when you're going to Kickstarter, because that was one of their main issues on on release, that, you know, I think people, they realized that people didn't like the fact that it was quite open-ended. They wanted, you know, a nice definitive ending and a nice, you know, definitive whole.
As I mentioned, I played the demo earlier today. I broke two things. I went into the options, swapped control schemes back and forth a couple of times before deciding I'll play keyboard and mouse, exited out of the menu, and all the button prompts were the controller. Because I've been swapping between them. I managed to work out the keys as I was going around. But then after I unlocked the bubble tonic, I somehow made it stop working. Because I got across to you have to unlock a door and then use some geysers to get up to it. Mm-hmm. And after I got up there, the bubble tonic wouldn't work anymore.
Oh, that's a new one.
Right, so I couldn't really explore anything else.
We'll definitely have to investigate that. You know, that's stressing me out a little bit. But,
I think no, it may
that
be related.
That was the puzzle design.
it may be related to the fact that I was because I'd slipped off that ledge a couple of times. I hadn't gone pushed forward far enough. So you hit the ledge, your bubble pops, and then the first time, fall, break your legs.
Yeah.
The second time, I realized that once the bubble pops, you can press the button again really quickly and form another bubble and save your life. So I think it might be related to me, like, basically hammering the button to make sure I didn't fall.
Oh, that's maybe strange. Potentially. We've just recently started to sort of refine our testing regime with stuff, because we've missed it. This is our first time we've ever released any form of, like, product to players. So there's been some learning curves, and one of that was sort of really nailing down the way we test the game internally, because we obviously can't afford QA testers. So a lot of the feedback, we really rely on our community coming forward and saying, oh, you know, this didn't work, but we really love this, but also that didn't work, because, you know, that's sadly the situation we're in. Hopefully now we'll be able to get more of a handle on some of the missed bugs, because it's hard to get everything, but we do really want to sort of log everything and get everything solved as quickly as possible, because it's just stuff you miss, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very interesting, because, you know, being at trade shows especially and seeing players play the game, you know, everyone plays it so differently. You know, you design it in one way and you think people are going to do it the way that you think. That's obvious, but who wouldn't do it that way? And then every player just, you know, walks left rather than right. You're like, okay, everyone's doing that, I guess.
I actually did that. I remember the first time I played Fallout 3. Go down here. You leave the vault. Go down here. Nope. I walked left. Went under a bridge. Got shot by raiders.
Yeah, that's something that you don't realize anyone's going to do until you see a bunch of people do it. So as much as we can internal test, like, you know, actual bugs and things not working, you know, there are some things that just happen from player experiences being very odd or them doing a weird series of things that, you know, we need to find through that. So it is a bit of a learning curve, getting that process sort of nailed. But I think it's definitely improving and going well at the moment, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. One question I wrote down, it was related to something that Edric said. What came first, the decision to call the helper Elpin or to make Edric have a Yorkshire accent?
Right. Because
Elpin sounds like, well, how you would say helping with a Yorkshire accent. As a Yorkshireman myself, I know that from experience.
Yeah, so the story behind Elpin's name is a bit of, you know, a dev story, which I'll tell now. You know, gather around the fireplace. So when we were doing that initial university project, figuring out the mechanic, our lead programmer Harry was drawing this idea for one platform being placed anywhere. And it was, you know, just the little sphere, which is open, with then another circle around it showing a platform. And after a while, we had drawn like 20 of them on a board, and we realized they all look like nipples. Elpin was named the nipple. And then nipple backwards is Elpin. And then we then simplified the spelling down to L-P1N for robot. And that's how the name Elpin came about. And then it was a happy accident that we realized that, oh, if you say Elpin, it sounds like you're saying he's, you know, helping you out. So that all together.
Our lecturer literally banned us naming the robot Nipple. He was like, you cannot name this robot Nipple. I was like, oh, damn. So we just spelled it backwards. And then even that we had to change to LP1N.
Yeah. No, but it was in the latest round of voice acting. The voice actor was very keen to try a Yorkshire accent, and he did it, and we absolutely loved it. So that was a very recent development. He was always, you know, pretty straight, pretty simple, you know, British, but we adapted into Yorkshire because it just made him, you know, more personable, and you know.
And we had three actors, two actors and one actress with the Queen's English, and it was three characters all with the Queen's English, and actually feel like it needs to be sort of jazzed up a bit. So I wanted Edric to have a Devonian accent because I'm from Devon, but our voice actor Gregory Cox was like, I don't think I can manage that. so he was I'm from Yorkshire, and then he gave it a go and it was really good. And
it gives it a nice open all hours touch.
Yeah.
Okay, what feature would you add if time and budget restraints weren't a thing?
Oh, God.
I've got three. firstly, I would implement seasons changing, because I want to promote the idea of this open world experience. I'd love it if all the puzzle elements had sort of, you know, three states they could be in, and then depending on the season, those states change, so the gameplay change and the puzzle would adapt around the season you're in. But visually we've got seasons changing as a pipeline in our stretch goals. Don't know if it's released that yet, but I'm gonna say it. I think what we'd really like is just to make the world feel a lot more dynamic with lots more animals and stuff like that. But animals are quite a lot of implementation with, you know, pathfinding and programming as well as animating and building them. I think making the world livelier with animals and lots of interactions like that. And then having this sort of, you know, overarching season changing and adapting the world around the season would be really cool. That's mine.
Yeah, that was actually the one I was going to say as well, but because Tom said it, I have to choose something else. So I think my one, actually, it was someone commented it on the other day. I think it was on a Kickstarter campaign. It might have been our Discord, though I can't remember, but someone mentioned about whether we'd ever do a co-op game. And for some reason that's really stuck with me, because I thought, God, that would change the game completely. But I'm almost morbidly interested in how much that would change it, and and I'd be quite up for it. I'd like to try that, but that's that's another kettle of fish. That would be a lot of work.
It'd be a completely different game, right? But as a designer, I get excited by the idea of the fact that, you know, you have one person playing Edric, one person playing Elpin. And you could just make things in a completely different way, having those two characters interacting as two players rather than just as one player.
Yeah.
I think that is a cool idea. Something that we'd love to maybe implement as a secondary game mode. But
Dev dreams.
Okay, well, what's something that's had to be cut for whatever reason that you really miss?
Potions, I would say. we had like a whole stack of potion ideas, which were really cool. Mm-hmm. And purely because of scope and scale, we just can't afford to do them at the moment. So we've had to cull back some of the potions that we mm-hmm. wanted to do. This was before the Kickstarter launch, though. This was a while ago. I think that's probably the main one for me.
Yeah, I think it's I think my cutting comes under scale and scope as well. There's going to be elements of them still in the game, but we had this idea for a really interesting dank forest swamp kind of area, which I was very excited for designing for, like puzzle wise. Mm. But just because of scope, we've replaced it with some other areas which are more similar to the current gameplay. I think I can't tell if I'm more excited to do the new ones or if I'm sad that the old one's gone. Just I had a few interesting ideas around that sort of area that was cool, and I'm sad I'm not gonna be able to do that. But you know, Project Grove 2, you know, we'll open up for swamp areas. Those are mine.
Okay, and what's one feature you really hope players are going to enjoy?
Ooh.
It's not like a new feature that I'm excited for people to try out. I think as a designer, I'm just stressed about that core mechanic of using Elpen, and I really want people to enjoy that. And we're always improving it, and, you know, updating, you know, tweaking numbers, tweaking animations, all that sort of stuff. I just really want people to enjoy that core experience of traveling around with your robot companion. I think that's the thing that I want people to really love doing.
Yeah, I think same here. When we were originally sort of the early stages of Project Grove, like within the first sort of month or two of after university, we had the most hideous control scheme for Elpin, and it made it so like unenjoyable. And it's like, I don't know, just like a few seconds to do the command to place him in the world. And like we kept getting feedback like, oh, this, like, we really like the concept and stuff. It like feels a bit off, but we really like it. And for ages we were like, why, you know, why doesn't this feel good? Why doesn't this feel good? And it took, I'd say, a good few months of refining to get Elpin to feel as good as he does now. Well, it really should be an it.
Yeah. I mean, we took Elpin from 5 buttons to use down to 1, and that was, you know, a process of about 3 months of, you know, every couple of days just redesigning the control scheme, seeing what worked, what didn't work.
Yeah. 5 months of face palming because we like, what were we thinking before?
that's
actually quite a surprise that you say that, because the what's there is simple and works really well.
Well, that's a relief to hear you say, but it wasn't an easy process getting there. Because the combination of, you know, 3D pathfinding and finding a way through 3D space, along with that feeling of, we want the player to feel like they can go anywhere. You know, they're not restricted to certain locations. And that's, those two things has already, like, made that a difficult process. I think we've gotten there now on the control scheme. I think there are still improvements we made to Elpin, but I think in terms of how the player controls him or controls Elpin is there. I think it's going really well.
Yeah, because before we kind of had like a toggle, like with your two triggers. This is probably the last control scheme we had with Elpin before this, now the changed one, and it was toggle the sort of left-right trigger or the mouse scroll to place his little hollow. The Elpin marker in the world, so you kind of could select the place you wanted free, like on your own sort of terms, without having it snap to anywhere. But it just took people like, I don't know, 5 times longer to like do a simple move, and that was our like core bread and butter mechanic that was just way too lengthy. It's like playing a like shooting game and manually loading up your gun each time. Like, it just wouldn't be fun. So
yeah,
so that's a VR games.
But I think in VR games, the reason it's fun is that sort of, you know, stress, that sort of impeding stress that you have to get this thing done. But, you know, in a more chilled puzzle game like ours, you really need that experience to feel like snappy and quick and free and flow well. Sort of the big design choice for us was like, we want that pick up and play. I think it's a really underrated thing for someone to be able to pick up your game and just instantly play it without too much, you know, teaching. And getting yourself close to that sort of perfect pick up and play, no tutorial experience is something that, you know, all designers strive for, but it's very hard to achieve. But I think we're getting closer.
Okay. Final question. What's been the funniest bug?
Funniest bug.
Elfin train, I want to say. Probably.
Yeah, Elpen Train, definitely.
That sounds promising.
Yeah, so after our university project, we did this competition. So we developed for another 3 months over our summer. And at the time, we had other students from our university playtesting. And there was one student who figured out that you could jump, place Elpen right below you, and he would just go there in place. And so you could go up into the sky indefinitely and go anywhere and skip the whole game. And this got dubbed the Elpen Train because you could just go anywhere and do anything by just jumping around on Elpen and just fly across the whole map, which was quite heart-wrenching to watch, but it was quite a funny experience.
Yeah, we can laugh at it now.
Yeah, we can laugh at it now that it's fixed. Now that it's not there anymore, we're allowed to laugh at it.
I'll be honest, I was a bit dismayed that Elpen didn't form quickly enough when I was falling to my doom. open, no, straight past.
Yeah, he will just let you die, you know.
Yeah, Open does his own thing sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the other funny bugs. Maybe like the ghost of Edric when he, like, his hands for some reason just stayed somewhere in the base for ages.
Oh yeah. So yeah, in the game we've got cinematic actors, so in the cutscenes you're not actually seeing the real version of the Edric and Elpen. You're seeing fake versions we use for cinematics only, and for a while those weren't hiding automatically. So you would sometimes just see floating hands around the level. It was sort of the ghost of Edric following you around the level. It's quite funny. But yeah.
It's really creepy.
Yeah, I think those are the highlights on, like, you know, humorous bugs.
Right. Well, thank you very much for coming, Emily and Tom. Do you want to stay for the news segment, or do you have things that you need to do?
I think we'll dash. You know, I think we've got things to do,
fire, right?
Sleep to have. You know, it's important. thanks so much for having us. It's been an absolute blast.
That's quite right. Make sure you check out Project Grove on Kickstarter. It's currently got 18 days to go as of this recording. This episode will be going up tonight, so 18 days. If you're listening to this as soon as we go up.
Yeah, amazing. Check us out on Kickstarter. If you have any questions for us, just message us on our Discord or on Kickstarter. We're pretty quick at replying. Thanks so much for having us, and enjoy your new segment.
Yeah, thank you so much. We really appreciate it, and thank you for the support and having us on here.
Yeah, our pleasure. Yeah, check out Antler Studios on twitch.tv, where you've got some programming out. It seems.
Yeah, we're trying to do our stream a couple times a week now. I think it's a really good way to, like, real time, you know, chat with people from Kickstarter and show our process. It's kind of a new thing, so I'm not used to, like, plugging it. But yeah, definitely check it out. Amazing.
And make sure to wishlist Project Grove on Steam.
Yes, on Steam. Yeah, it's up there. Wishlist it. That makes us happy. You know, it's a nice number to look at, and it really helps with the Steam algorithms as well. So it's a great thing to do for us. Thank you.
All right, thank you again for coming.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Right, our first news topic. It kind of broke before we went to record last week, but I didn't have time to look into it, so we're talking about it now. Animal Crossing New Horizon. It's been confirmed that the game's only going to let you have one island per console. well, per copy of the game per console. So if you have four accounts that want to play Animal Crossing New Horizons, you each need to have a copy of the game or you're stuck on the same island together.
This is a bit of a weird thing because I know in the past they've had it so it was like one island per version, like per cartridge. At least I think that was the case. So like if you wanted to have two islands, you needed to buy two copies of the game, but you could have one 3DS. This is really weird that they're doing it console locked, so to speak. Especially considering as well that like I honestly can't think of any reason why they would.
The GameCube's excuse was that one town took up an entire memory card. Like, not even most of them. It took an entire memory card. You couldn't have any other saves on that.
Gosh. I mean, is that maybe the case? No. I know they're doing, like, online... Well, they're doing, like, multiplayer in this one, aren't they? Like, proper multiplayer, I believe. I'm sort of out of touch on Animal Crossing. So I wonder if maybe that's the reason, but the thing is, like, surely, hypothetically, if you and me, Ace, are playing this game, we've each got our own copy of the game, but we're sharing a Switch, which means we have the same island. Is it instancing that island? So do we each have our own save, or are we messing around with each other's island? That's because if it's instancing the islands, then why can't we just have a different island each? I don't understand.
Perhaps each it's like a fingerprint. Each Switch has their own island that it draws from some code somewhere that's maybe hardwired into the Switch. It's very weird. I was hoping someone else would be here who could carry that a bit longer, but we've had some technical issues and some people unavailable, so we'll move on. Dan Houser is going to leave Rockstar Games, according to an official document released on the 4th of February. He's the co-founder of Rockstar Games. He's leaving on the 11th of March. Though no definitive reason has been given for his departure.
I guess, like, it's kind of an odd one because, yeah, like, the amount of time and projects that Dan's worked on is a bit sudden, but, like, I guess maybe...
He hasn't worked on many in recent years, has he?
Considering how long it takes Rockstar to make a game. But I guess...
They used to release one a year.
True.
Max Payne, Billy.
To be fair, Dan probably has a lot of money. So it could be early retirement, or maybe he's just going to go do something else. Who knows? It's always interesting when people announce they're leaving a company, especially in this kind of vein, because this, as far as we're aware, like on the surface, this comes across as just Dan Houser has just decided to leave. That might not be the case. There might be something more political or internal going on. Who knows? But on the surface, it seems like Dan Houser has just decided, yeah, I'm going to leave. It's whatever. I know a lot of people, like last year, left Blizzard. We had like a sort of almost like a mass exorcism of the original Blizzard people. Are we going to see this with Rockstar? I don't know. But until Dan Houser or Take-Two or Rockstar themselves speak more on the matter, we'll...
It doesn't seem like a spur-of-the-moment decision, because it's still a couple of weeks until he leaves officially. So if more people are going to follow, then it's... surely there wouldn't have been an official announcement about it.
True, and as obviously the news story goes on to point out, like the fact that people are still waiting for single player DLC, and you know, a lead writer leaving kind of is a bit like, you know, that might impact that. Although to be fair, at this point, like if if you're expecting single player DLC, I would just give up hope at this point. Mind you, I was going to say, like, it's like waiting for Half-Life 3, but then Half-Life Alyx has become a thing, so...
But that's still not Half-Life 3.
This is true. Is this the new Half-Life 3? Rockstar doing single player DLC?
at least they didn't promise any for Red Dead Redemption 2, at least.
Well, no, that's the thing. Maybe that is the DLC. Maybe they just got a bit confused and made a whole game instead. Well, here's your single player, but we want the GTA. Oh, we thought you said Cowboys. It's an honest mistake.
Michael, we thought you said Morgan.
But hearing the word Morgan makes me think of Prey and how we probably won't get a second Prey. Not Prey 2 as in the one that was canned years ago, but as in Arkane Studios Prey 2. I don't know if we'll ever get that, and I really would, because Prey was good.
Prey was very good. Something else that was very good. Mutant Year Zero, Road to Eden was, pretty good. It got mentioned in our Game of the Year awards, and so the Bearded Ladies, the developer of Mutant Year Zero, have announced their next game, Corruption 2029. Not only have they announced it, but they've also announced it's coming out on the 17th of February this year.
Which is like,
mad.
Yeah. To add to that as well, it is an Epic Store exclusive. So, like
our guests were just saying, you can either throw time or money at a problem. So they've thrown some money at
it. Right. This is a really interesting one, because Mutant Year Zero is a really, really nice game. It's based on some really fantastic source material. It's a great it's a good tactics game in the vein of XCOM. Interesting characters, interesting world, really nice engine because it's like visually impressive, etc. All that stuff. Really, really cool. They did a couple of updates and a little bit of like an expansion. It got a console version. Awesome. This is a weird one because based on the trailer we've got, which is like the only trailer we've got, two things. One, that is a really awkward trailer. It kind of starts a bit suspenseful, building up the tension, and then suddenly you just get wob-wob. You get dubstep wob-wob music and a bit of a weird montage of like gameplay. It's not bad. It's just it kind of caught me by surprise. I was a bit like, oh, okay, we're doing 2012 again, like, you know, Syndicate style trailers. Again, they were good, actually. But the other thing as well, and again, I don't want to sound overly cynical, but based on this short look and the limited gameplay in it, it does honestly just look like a reskin of Mutant Year Zero, which I don't mind, but I find it just a bit random. I don't know.
Well, the description we've been given, it pits players as augmented super soldiers against a malevolent corporation that pulls the strings of society. Turn-based strategic gameplay that focuses on stealth, tactical options are always open. Alternative routes, vantage points, smart positioning may give players the upper hand in combat or even help them avoid it entirely. I don't think that's story-wise similar to Mutant Year Zero. I haven't played the game.
Oh, no.
I don't like this style of game personally, but...
I didn't mean in terms of narrative, but like so there's a bit in the trailer, I've just got it up on my screen now. To be quite blunt, the actual gameplay, the UI, like it, and the visuals themselves, it looks like they've just done like a mod kind of thing. Like it's if someone had shown me this and said, hey, I made a mod for Mutant Year Zero, I would have believed you. That's not to say it's bad. I'm curious because I liked Mutant Year Zero and I'm a sucker for these kind of games. And hey, give me some futuristic Syndicate style, bring down a corporation with a limited team. Fuck yeah, I'm down with that. It's just a bit peculiar. And the thing is as well is the trailer's been getting a lot of negative reactions from people, mostly slandering it because it's like, Epic Store, because apparently that's still a thing that people want to go on about. Seriously, it's 2020. Exclusives are a thing. Come on. But also because people are saying similar things. Like it just seems like a reskin of Mutant Year Zero. I don't I want to see more. I mean, it's out in like a few days. And if I'm not mistaken, it's actually quite cheap as well. Like it's, I might be mistaken on that one, but I'm sure I read somewhere that it's like less than £20.
Well, in fairness to them, Mutant Year Zero did really well, and reskinning it would cut down on development time and allow them to put out another game in a similar vein to something that's already been well received.
Potentially. And, like, please, you know, don't... listeners, please don't take me saying that it looks like a reskin as a negative, because, again, as Ace pointed out, it's if it's... Hey, if there's a cost-effective way of making an interesting game, then why not? And honestly, like, looking at some screenshots of Mutant Year Zero just very quickly alongside Corruption, like, yeah, there's clearly improvements visually. And if the system... Hey, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know? If it works, why not? And again, if they are indeed not charging a full £60 for it, then, hey, then why not? No, I see no problem there.
I'm curious how much Mutant Year Zero is. Mutant Year Zero is £30. But with that epic money, perhaps they've decided to drop it. Speaking of things that have been dropped, System Shock 3 is... well, after several confirmed layoffs at Other Side, the developers of System Shock 3, late last year, and more departures from the company have made it all but certain that it's not going to see the light of day. Our news story says an anonymous ex-member of the studio claims that the entire System Shock 3 team is now unemployed. In addition, the writer and director, lead programmer, and design director have all confirmed their own departures from the company at various points in the last 5 months. So yeah, that's I know several people who were really looking forward to another entry in the System Shock universe, because System Shock 2 was a very well-liked game. Looks like the third one is no more.
That is a real shame, because I was very interested in seeing it sort of come to fruition. And obviously, as we've said multiple times in this podcast, it is always a shame to hear about developers losing their jobs by any means. So fingers crossed that all those affected can actually find new jobs sooner rather than later. And yeah, I guess that sucks massively.
The Other Side website was, WordPress blog. Seriously, it's /WP in the URL, was last updated 15th of October, and that was about an Oculus Quest game, Underworld Overlord. I would delve into the forums, but that's... don't read the comments, folks.
Yeah. Ah, yeah, that is a shame. Also, not to jump back onto Corruption, but just to confirm, it is indeed $15.99 on the Epic Store. I just checked. Also, System Shock 3. Wasn't that kickstarted? Or am I thinking of something else?
I can't remember. One of the System Shock games went into Kickstarter. I don't know if it was the remake, the remaster of System Shock 2, or even System Shock. We should Google.
Yeah, because I honestly can't remember.
Yeah, it was the remake System Shock by Night Dive Studios, which did come out.
Oh, that actually did.
Oh, no. My mistake. It is coming out early this year.
Hmm.
Last week I completely messed up the platforms that a game was coming out on, and this week I'm telling people that a game's out when it's not. I apologize, folks.
I'm just looking at the System Shock Remake Steam page, and the first screenshot has what I can only describe as E.T. with bloodthirsty vengeance trying to kill the player. It is... I don't even know what I'm looking at. It's terrifying. But also hilarious.
It's weird to me that they'd remake System Shock when, I believe, at least System Shock 2 was the more critically acclaimed out of the two.
Also, in the screenshots, the way the player's holding the wrench makes no sense. Like, their little finger is noticeably smaller than their ring finger. Or if
it
I just...
Is your little finger as big as your ring finger?
Well, no, like, but I'm just thinking, like, the way... Like, if I
hold... Mine's an entire knuckle shorter.
Really?
More or less.
Mine's like, if I bend, like, so if I like put my hands into like a grip position, if my hand's flat, it's in line with the lower knuckle, but then if I fold my hand, oh god, I'm so confused.
I've just taken hold of a power block, and the little finger is not that much shorter than the other fingers. And on that confusing note, I think we've reached the end of the podcast. Thank you for joining me, Nikki, Emily, and Tom, our two guests from earlier. And an even bigger thank you to you for subscribing and listening, whether you're doing that via Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or our RSS feed. You can leave a review on iTunes, follow us on Spotify, or post a cheeky comment on GameGreen.com. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch too. And while you're at it, game on.